Hello to you, yes you, and thank you for tuning in to Taking It Down. If this is your first time with us, welcome. We are the Pop Culture Discussion Podcast for the Alabama Take, and at that website you can find everything associated with us housed under one roof, conveniently. For this podcast, Taking It Down, we mostly discuss television and movies, some music here and there. A couple of times a year we'll even grab a book and read it. We do have a tendency to talk sports in a broad sense every now and again. You know, be aware that football season's on the horizon. I bet we'll talk college football games here and there in the fall. But we are the Alabama Takes Pop Culture Discussion Pod. If you're new to us, thanks for coming. I am the host, Blaine Duncan. Joining me today, got two co-hosts as usual. I got Adam Morrow on deck, and I've got Natalie Morrow on deck. The married couple of the Alabama Take. How about that?
How about it?
How about
it? You just missed it. Listeners, you just missed a heated conversation about whose job it was to make more coffee at the house. So we got all sorts of domestic issues coming to the surface this week.
No Donovan again this week. He's really using up that paid time off.
Good for him.
He's getting paid?
In actuality, Donovan is off while he wraps up filming for the upcoming season of The Challenge.
Man.
Be fascinating. Donovan in that house.
That would rule.
I think he'd do pretty well.
So, quick thoughts on the trailer that dropped this week. We're all three Challenge fans this week, so.
I mean, I didn't know. I knew that it was coming soon, but when it dropped, whatever day, I guess that was Wednesday, I just had just panic, but like excited panic. Just like texted everybody I knew, just like, prepare yourselves. Mm-hmm. This is happening. I will see you on this date at this time. The only sport that matters is back.
There you go. Adam, what were your initial thoughts?
I was excited. I like that it's coming back at the right time, I think. You know, we had a more of a break this go than has happened in the last few years. They're back on kind of a regular filming process. But, you know, dropping the trailer in August 11th, that's going to be here before we know it. That's not too long to wait.
That's so soon.
I like
that. That's so soon. So we got... When I saw it, my initial reaction was Devin, Kyle, CT, and Fessy. That mix right there, I'm in. I was a little disappointed with the recycling of the spy or bunker theme.
I'm with you on that. They seem to want to do trilogies as much as they can in this world. And
really?
Yeah, but it used to take, people have pointed out, like, you know, the Gauntlet and Inferno and all of those. They took time off between that theme, right? Like, they switched it around quite a bit. Arrivals, you know, Arrivals wasn't three rival shows in a row. It was, they let things percolate in between.
Right.
I'm kind of over the whole spy. That's my only complaint. I'm with you, Blaine.
They do a great job of throwing surprises in, so I guess I'll hold my judgment. But that's the only thing that I was disappointed. I thought, when I saw the trailer, I thought, well, this looks almost like the previous season's trailer. So, but
yeah.
I looked at the... I paused the trailer a couple of times and made sure I saw who I thought I saw, and I'm pumped as anybody.
A lot of new faces this go.
Yeah, I mean, it's half rookies.
That's going to be entertaining, and watching, well, I mentioned, you know, watching Devin and Fessy and throw Kyle in there to comment on it. Hey, there's your television show.
Absolutely. And CT is, any pictures that have come out recently, if he looks like he's... And CT's in fighting shape this time. I think he's coming in pretty good shape, cut a little bit of weight.
And then Donovan's going to be on there, which I can't wait.
I think they're...
What would Donovan... Let's just speculate.
Okay,
what would Donovan be like in a challenge house?
I want to know who he would pick as his partner, or who would pick him as their partner.
No one. No one would pick Donovan. Here's the thing about...
Little Amber would.
Yeah, maybe so. Here's the thing about Donovan, though. I remember this. I mean, obviously, we're well over a decade removed from this, but like in college, Donovan was, he's a little bit more wiry and athletic than you think he is. He kind of got some of that like squirrel tactics kind of thing going on, that he may be tougher. You know, he grew up military dad. They moved around. He kept him in good shape, all that kind of stuff. He's a tougher guy than he lets on.
Donovan hits the treadmill and the other calisthenic gym equipment, from what he says.
It would be, he'd, you know, obviously be one of the smarter ones there. He could probably figure the games out. Executing is different, but his house politics would be fascinating to me. They would have no idea what to do.
Oh, it'd be hilarious.
Natalie, do you remember Leroy's first partner on Rivals 1? Was it Mike? Was that his name?
Yes.
That's the closest we've come to having Donovan on the show.
Yeah.
Just a lovable guy.
Just total nerd.
Try hard. Loved his buddy Leroy. They were a fun team.
Okay, we'll shift gears. Let's talk about the elephant in the room. That's going to be the Loki finale. We'll keep the first half of our podcast today MCU based, and then on the back half we'll vary it up a little. Loki finale. Natalie, got to toss it to you first. Give me some big grand thoughts. And if you haven't seen the Loki finale, we're spoiling it. So hit the skip button to the find the timestamp and go to the next segments.
This whole season that has been, I mean, we've already talked about how it's been very, just not a whole lot of action, just a lot of conversation between compelling characters and the actors that are talented enough to pull it off, and including Jonathan Majors in that. It was so good, to the point where a lot of times when I ask Adam to watch these shows with me, like, I know he'll probably watch it but not be that into it, and I was excited for him to see this episode and to finish out the season because it was great, and it's setting up the next phase for the MCU, and it's so exciting. I just can't wait.
A heavily important show for the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
It's impressive they did it with one of their TV shows. I'm glad they did, though. That's fine. Adam, did that last scene give you some heavy Twin Peaks The Return vibes?
It is happening again. Yeah, I thought it was...
He walks up to Mobius, and Mobius is like, first of all, who are you? And he realizes he's in a different timeline.
Well, he hears it. I thought it was great. I thought that a lot of the talk I know has centered... Obviously, you guys are much more well-versed in what the talk is and has been for the last few days. But the idea that there wasn't that much action, it was a lot of talking in the last episode. And they kind of buried a character until the last minute. And the guts that it takes to be an actor of that caliber for your final scenes and then have him carry the entire episode. And I thought it really worked. There were episodes that, I'm going to be honest, I kind of looked at my phone through some of them, but this one was, I think, one of the better ones.
This is one of those episodes where I really would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in the writer's room. It had to have been a big, fun mess, you know? And how hard would it have been to write this one?
Yeah, the keeping track of all the rules.
It's definitely the way that the next Doctor Strange movie's plot will work in dealing with this stuff, as well as the next Spider-Man movie. And obviously, this is going to be the way that the X-Men and the Fantastic Four are introduced. That's what I'm seeing, right?
I mean, it better be, because...
You've been adamant about the X-Men.
If I don't get X-Men, if I don't get mutants in the next 4 years, I'm going to be very upset.
Tell me more. How does that work? How does X-Men tie into this?
You mean theoretically or from the comics?
Give me the simple reason why you're going to be pissed if there are not mutants based on the end of the show. Like, what? How did you make that jump?
Well, it should be. So there's the whole, like, the property rights, who owned the X-Men characters for these movies.
The real world.
Which has now shifted back. Right. So it's now all shifted back to Marvel. But the way that they should finally be able to introduce them is once we have all these different timelines and different universes collapsing. So, like, the next Spider-Man movie, you know, that's rumored supposed to be, you know, bringing in some of the Sony characters, like whatever. Was that Sony? Was that who had those rights?
You're right. Andrew Garfield is supposed to be, and he previously played Spider-Man, so we're going to have like three different Spider-Men.
From all the old actors. Right, so this is the time. They've got the rights, and now they've got the right storyline, or the, I don't know, plot, I guess. That this is how it can happen, and it can happen easily. It's just another universe, and now they're all colliding, so let's get the X-Men. Let's get the mutants, mm-hmm. because there's no reason not to. And that's such a huge thing that they have to work with now, that it would be really dumb if they didn't and then tried to bring it in later.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they're going to do it. If I was Kevin Feige, here's what I would do. I think next year, or, you know, whenever it's possible, you do an 8-episode X-Men show. You hire people who fit the mold, but who are unknowns, but just full of potential. Just cast a bunch of unknowns, but
like
who
Donovan.
Are great. Like, you know, go through the, like Donovan. And just get you a bunch of young folks who are, I mean, these casting directors, they're trained, they're talented, they know what to do. get yourselves 10 or 12 fantastic young actors and just roll with it and sign them to a four-picture deal or whatever. And I know Feige came out and said that they're not doing multi-picture deal, and that was kind of interesting and also kind of disappointing, and you're wondering, what does that mean? Are they going to even try for another big Avengers movie? Are those days gone? Natalie, I saw you react to that. Do you have thoughts on Feige saying that?
I mean, I guess I understand. Maybe my hope is that what he's talking about is these, like, the deal that he had with, like, Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans, like, that span, maybe. But if we don't get, like, I know we're jumping into, I'm going to say that just, we'll talk about this later. But if we don't get more of Florence Pugh for the next few movies or TV shows or whatever, you know, they're introducing all these characters to kind of continue the story. That it's got to be, I mean, I could see it being 4 to 5, you know, things, but maybe it's not these, like, whatever. How many movies was Tony Stark in?
9 or 10. Chris Evans was in, like, 9 or something like that, even as small cameos, I think.
So I could see it not being, like, maybe, I'm hoping what he's saying is maybe half that would be fine. But there has to be this continuation, because everything is so intertwined now, especially now that we're going to have this multiverse thing happening. You can't do these, like, one-off character shows or movies. It's just not going to, nobody's going to buy it anymore, because we know that they're there.
Three things going off what you said. One, Brie Larson seems to be one of the deciding factors. I think she's a little bit upset about her role in Marvel. Second thing is Florence Pugh is guaranteed to show up in the Hawkeye show, which is, of course, we're going to get into this in a minute. And third, Hiddleston is going to reprise his role in the season 2 of Loki, and he seems really excited about that. He's been already chatting online about getting up for that and being really happy about it. So, which you would have thought, he's shown up in almost as many movies as Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr., so you would think he was kind of tired of it, but I think he got rejuvenated from just getting to really ham it up and really do some great acting in these last couple episodes where he got to be sad over Sylvie. He got to show a range of emotions. I'm sure that's fun for an actor.
I heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I heard that there was maybe some, I don't know if tension's the right word, but the amount of attention that Loki got from his performance in Ragnarok, that maybe Hemsworth wasn't very psyched on that, or was just like, hey, these are supposed to be my movies. And so they kind of redirected and were like, okay, we're going to let Tom Hiddleston take this other direction with the show, which I can't imagine he's got to show up in, I don't know if he will, but Doctor Strange, or I would imagine he's going to show up in some of the places where, you know, Jonathan Majors' character shows up at some point, but.
Or maybe he's just stuck at the TVA for now.
That could be it too. If he's on this weird different timeline, then makes sense.
See, they've written themselves into, I was worried it was going to be a hole, but as it turns out, they've written themselves into a very smart place, like you said.
Yeah.
Jonathan Majors was just told, cut loose and fuck it up, wasn't he?
And he did a great job.
I mean, I've never seen him do this sort of role. He was cutting up. He was clowning.
Yeah, it was funny. It was so funny. And like, but like in a really kind of like a nerving way. Like, the villain to be this casual, he clearly has nothing to fear, which makes him a pretty scary dude.
Yeah, and then when he reveals he's actually probably the smartest person in the room.
And potentially, like, the nicest of all the bad guys, and here comes worse.
Yeah. So, in a way, I thought that the finale was good and bad. The acting was fantastic. That was the best. Just watching these people chew up their script was just fun. But it was, for me, a little bit too much talking and explanation that could have been handled previously. For me, it was, a little. For a finale. Had this been the penultimate episode, I wouldn't have thought that. We'll go to the both of you. Were you satisfied? It sounds like, Natalie, you were. I'll let you elaborate. Were you satisfied for it to be a finale? Or would you like more of a wrap-up? You know, the whole leaving you hanging with him in another plot line. Is that okay with you?
It is, because we know we have an idea of what's coming in some of the future movies. We already know we're getting a Loki season 2. So for me, I'm fine with it. And I'm excited about it, because it's just now I get to, like, there's something there's a storyline to look forward to instead of just like a title, you know?
Adam, did it satisfy you for a finale?
It did. I liked the information drop being kind of the big action, and the decision that has to be made between Loki and Sylvie was enjoyable. That tension, it turned into like a very philosophical thing, like the creating a multiverse that is ultimately fairly, I mean, it's a nihilistic multiverse, right? It's not really like there's a ton of potential out there. It's,
I think it could be.
Yeah, like it's, when he tells Sylvie, like, I'll see you right back here again, you know, with just total certainty, like, that's more interesting to me than zipping around through different timelines. You know what I mean? Like, that it's somehow all connected and inevitable in a way. That's an interesting idea that gives more weight to any future storylines to me than maybe other franchises or individual films or whatever. They just create an infinite number of places you can jump around to. Like, that's not that interesting, just for the sake of it. I thought this was a very satisfying setup for whatever comes next.
From what I understand, season two of Loki is going to have him be able to fold the timeline so that he can go into this chamber and then come out and everything will be backwards. No, that's Tenet. I'm sorry. I get the confused. Last question related to the finale. Any disappointment that you did not get Owen Wilson on a jet ski?
Heavy.
I mean, yeah, for sure. I really want to. That should have been the post-credit
scene.
That's
what I was going to say. The post-credit scene is just him riding around somewhere on a lake outside Austin, Texas or something, having a real good time.
Like, not even in character.
Yeah.
Just him.
Oh, yeah.
Just Owen Wilson. Well, let's keep it MCU. We'll keep it on the MCU rails, but we'll jump cars to the most recent film entry of the MCU. It's Black Widow. That one had a hard time getting to viewers because of COVID-19. Scarlett Johansson was doing interviews last March before, I think it was a May release. We should have been talking about Black Widow this time, give or take last year, but instead it's 2021. The character of Black Widow, played, of course, by Scarlett Johansson, I mentioned, she finally has her own movie. Not only that, she has her own movie after her character's death in Endgame. It seems like a slap in the face or proper goodbye. You could read it either way, I think. It's all in the eyes of the beholder. But, of course, you could have went into the movie thinking, was Endgame her actual death? Does this movie going to, is it, would it resurrect her somehow? Or is it giving her a farewell? If you haven't seen it by now, we will spoil it. So check those timestamps, jump ahead to the next segment. Yeah, Black Widow. We all three saw it this week. We didn't talk about it when it premiered. I think we all had trouble getting instantly to the theater. Were you okay with being back in the theater? Sans pandemic, or it's really not sans pandemic. It's, I don't know, vaccinated now. Were you okay?
It was weird. I thought it was weird. The more people that walked into our theater, like, the more nervous I got, and the more I was thinking about, I should have grabbed my mask out of the car. But then once the movie starts, it's fine. But there was definitely like something in the back of your head that's just like, is this right? Are we okay?
I did not have that feeling. That was the first time back in the theater, but it felt, I guess I've done enough at this point that it was not, if that had been, you know, like my first, if I hadn't been to a concert or a restaurant or whatever, I would maybe have felt differently. But I was excited to be back. I started checking yesterday morning when I woke up. I was like, oh, what movies are coming this week? Maybe I'll go again. It's just so nice to be back and enjoy a film that way.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out if Green Knight was released this weekend.
Yep.
And if I was going to go see it. That's exactly what I was doing. It felt very, I thought about it a couple of times at the beginning of the trailers, when the trailers were dropping on the screen. I thought, this feels back to normal. This feels natural. But I also had the tendency to go to the movies at the earliest showing on like a Sunday or a Saturday. So there would be a smattering of people anyway. So that was kind of what I did this time. I went on a Monday, I think, just a few people. And there was a lady not too far from me who had a mask on and kept it on, I think. Okay, well, let's get in the movie itself. I'll open up by saying this was easily Marvel's darkest movie yet. And I was happy for that. I was glad they gave that a try. It had some emotional beats it was going to shoot for, and I think it succeeded. I could see how a few people may not think agree with my sentiments there.
I thought it was really, I liked that this was a movie that I could, like I told my mom, she, you know, I called her when it was over, and my dad, I heard him in the background say, was it good? Should I go see it? It's like, absolutely, you should go see it. Also, even though my mother hasn't watched any of these by her own free will, and would not choose to watch these, this is a movie I think could basically stand alone. Like, you don't necessarily need to have seen every other Marvel movie to be able to watch this movie. It's just a good movie. You know, there's like there's the action, of course, but then it's a lot of like family dynamics, that sort of thing. Great story. The acting was great. I'm in. It was a good time.
I thought it was good. I agree. I went into it with maybe tempered expectations based on some of the, I tried not to read anything to avoid, you know, I don't like reading too much before going into a movie, but it seemed like a lot of people wanted to give it like a C grade as compared to other Marvel movies.
Shit.
Well, it just seemed like in the true meaning of like, it's an average Marvel film. And I disagree with that quite a bit. I thought it was really good. I thought that, like y'all are saying, the darker tone really worked for me. And I think that every actor involved was very good. They just were able to do things, you know, the emotional heavy lifting and the comedic timing were both great. And I don't think that's always true in comic book movies. Like, it actually made me laugh. I should have looked up how many times you're allowed to say shit in a PG-13 movie, because they had to use every single one of them.
Yeah.
And Florence Pugh got the lion's share, and I thought that, man, there's nothing funnier than that. A well-timed shit.
in both literally and...
Exactly.
A lot of characters asking Natasha about the Avengers.
I thought that was cool. The idea that she... Well, it does two things. It places... You get a kind of a... And they do this in a few other movies where you kind of see outside the bubble what people are thinking about these characters, which is... Mm-hmm. Always fascinating to me. It's for the, you know, one of the Spider-Man movies opens this way with, like, you know, who cleans up after the fight? You know, those kind of, like, the normal everyday people, how do they perceive this? But it also places her as someone who has, like, in a way, a hometown hero who's made good. You know, it helped establish her as that kind of character. Even people on the opposite side are still impressed with what she's accomplished in her life.
Neither of you have watched The Americans.
We watched a season or so.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That opening set of scenes, straight out of The Americans, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is fine. I did think it lagged a little in the middle. Just some. But I thought it was so strong. And if you take into consideration that they're trying to make you care about a character whose fate is already sealed... And have you invest 2 hours of your time into someone who's already died. I really think that it's impressive in that alone. But not only that, they told an interesting story that went beyond her character. It's a fitting goodbye, I thought. And I was also appreciative of the film dealing with, in its own Marvel PG-13 way, the issues that came out of Me Too. I can't be the only person who saw Harvey Weinstein in the antagonists. I can't be. Did you guys not think that? I kept thinking it.
I didn't think it, but now that you say it, for sure.
I mean, he kind of had this shape. He wanted to control women.
Yeah.
Everything. Like you were saying, Natalie, there are two really strong themes, and I love it when my popcorn movie or television show also tries to deal with a few heavier things. And this one was dealing with women's rights and how we treat women, how we look at women, but and also family and who makes up your family. So I honestly think this is when you take those things into account, I honestly think this is a top five Marvel movie.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I was kind of going through my top three or four. And honestly, I would put, if we're talking top five of all of the Disney or all of the Marvel things, I think this fits in. And I would put Loki in that top five.
Oh, okay. You're talking shows too.
Yeah. And none of the other shows, yeah. I mean, they're, you know, WandaVision was great, but I would move movies out of my top five to put Loki in it, and I would absolutely put Black Widow up there too.
Adam, were you as impressed?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of it was maybe to do with, there are great things about, I mean, all these movies have some entertainment level, but they all try to, you know, in the fight scenes and the set pieces and all that kind of stuff. But where the good ones shine is how much emotional lifting and exploration they can do for me. And this one was as close to, for a superhero movie, it felt very real life. You know, like the things that were, even though it's extraordinary circumstances, obviously this is not just a like a drama movie, you know, about family, but in the heightened reality of mm-hmm. the Marvel Universe, yeah, I thought it did a lot of, like you both have said, that for it to be a PG-13 superhero movie, it's doing a lot. So yeah, this is, I would put it in my top five.
Our buddy Jeff would disagree with this, right?
Reckon so.
He seemed down on it, right?
I have seen a fair number of people say that it was fun, enjoyable, that everybody's very good in it, that it moved along at a nice clip, but it didn't maybe have the substance of some other ones. I don't know if that's his position. I'm not putting words in his mouth, but I think it's much better than that.
We should have him on. We'll have him on next week and have him defend himself.
No, it's more fun just to do it without him here.
Let's go into our break. It sounds like we all three recommend Black Widow. Most people have seen it, I'm assuming, who are listening to this so far. We'll take a break. On the other half, we're going to talk HBO's show The White Lotus and Saving the Best for Last, maybe. Hulu's show McCartney 321. So we're happy to bring you this podcast every Tuesday, and we hope you're a regular, a subscriber. If not, you can remedy that today by subscribing, by rating, by reviewing, by sharing, or by just being our friend or telling a friend. As mentioned at thealabamatake.com, there's everything you'd want from our site. And if you want to donate to help the site continue churning along, you can do that there. If you want to watch an episode of the highly lauded talk show Short Takes, well, you don't even have to go to YouTube. You can find that over at the website embedded there. If you're curious as to what we think about college football or the MTV staple The Challenge, or maybe the most recent season of the FX Hulu show Breeders, it's all there on the site. Speaking of Short Takes, this week's guest is musician Will Kimbrough, known throughout the South and well beyond for his songwriting and musical skills. I'll sit and talk to him. Those are out every Friday morning. Let's get back on into our show today. In this segment, I'm going to pull up the monitor, pull up the EQ. We're going to listen to every Speckled Bird and Della Ray song, and I'm gonna drop some things out of the mix, and we're going to have Natalie and Adam tell me everything that happens in these.
Perfect.
In these songs.
I thought you were going to give each one a pitchfork rating. That sounds more fun.
I could. Honestly, the next thing up on to get off our chest are our thoughts on this brand new HBO show, The White Lotus. Adam, it's no secret that you and I imagine Natalie too are fans of a good HBO show on a Sunday evening. This is something we've been missing since Mayor of Easttown. And though I'll say Mayor actually did a thing where I think it aired an hour later than I'm used to for an HBO Sunday night drama. It was like at 9 p.m. Central rather than 8 p.m. That threw me off, so I had to watch it on Monday.
Gotta get those kids to bed before you watch Mayor.
Gotta get the kids to bed. I also tend to go to bed a little early on a work night. This, we may not have a lot to say about this show because only one episode has aired, but I do want to comment on it a little bit. Just in case you don't know, let's break it down before we spoil anything. The White Lotus is an HBO drama with dashes of some dark humor to set up like this social satire. It's all centered around this Hawaiian resort it's the titular name. The White Lotus is the name of the resort. And overall, I think you'll see headlines that it's just another show about miserable white people. And in the case of the White Lotus show, they're privileged and miserable and white. So is that, I'll ask both of you, is it hard to meet the show where it was or where it is right now? Adam, did you find that off-putting?
No, I didn't. But I'm also a total sucker for the classic, let's get some characters into a closed space and do some psychological exploration or some sociological exploration. So I may be the target demographic for this, but I thought the first episode set up you know, a short season of HBO style miniseries pretty well. A lot of different voices going on, just the right amount of dark comedy. I'm in. I mean, it does have what you're talking about, privilege. Everybody there has paid their way in or is in the service industry, one of the two. So there's an interesting, or maybe a closed world view, but it doesn't, based on the first episode, it doesn't bug.
Natalie, were you kept at arm's length by the premise?
No, not at all. You know, and I think there's enough, kind of like Adam said, you know, a lot of what we see is from the viewpoint of like the hotel manager or the new hire, whatever her name was, Lonnie or something. So I think going forward, we're going to get these multiple viewpoints.
I think the hotel manager is going to be a real character. That guy seems like he's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
He was played pretty three dimensions to his character, because he starts, you get kind of one view of him to me, but then say when the new hire goes into labor, he's more empathetic with her. You know, you could see that character only being a hard ass, like get her out of the hotel, you know, and not sympathetic to what's going on, but he seems to be a bit more caring than that.
So before we jump into really spoiling some things, this show is created and ran by Mike White, who's done some broad, really great comedy like School of Rock. That's one of my favorite movies ever. Still one of my favorite movies. But he's also done things like The Emoji Movie. I think he wrote for it, and Pitch Perfect 3. So he can be hit or miss, I think. But he's also done like this HBO show, Enlightened, which is a darling of critics. Anyway, we got this pilot episode we're going to talk about just small chunk of time today. It did a lot of setup, and that's fine. You expect that in first episode. But I do have two questions. Adam, you wanted to really discuss a scene from the pilot.
I kept asking you guys, you know what it is. We watched it last Sunday night. Usually we have to catch up on our HBO. Sunday nights have, for some reason during the pandemic, Sunday nights became the night for like a fire pit kind of gathering.
Cool.
With friends. So we're behind usually. But we watched it live last Sunday night. And I thought, how many days am I going to have to wait before I get to have a text conversation about Steve Zahn's scrote? And it turns out almost a full week.
Or his body double. It's probably...
Yeah. I think that may have been a prosthetic situation, but...
Could have very well been.
Not only did that scene set up kind of the tension of the episode, right? One of the tensions of the episode.
Sure.
It was so funny. That's like the dark humor of the show to me. Like when he's checking again in the surf with his kid, you know? They're supposed to be snorkeling, and there's that scene of the underwater camera showing. That's great. That's just, it's funny. I love it.
And he's just perpetually worried about the phone call from the doctor, and damn if I can't relate to that. How many times have you gone to have, you know, something removed from, like, your shoulder, and you waiting on the phone call to hear if it's cancerous or simply benign?
They're very relatable.
It happens to everyone.
Yeah, I think maybe that's your question about privilege. You know, obviously he's waiting it out at a resort in Hawaii, but that's a very relatable point to be at, I guess. You know, any kind of anxiety like that.
Yeah, and what a way, if you're going to do one of the ultimate anxieties for a guy, that's what you do, I suppose.
Yeah, and it kind of grounded it a bit in, you know, when you realize he's worrying so much because his son is the age that he was when his dad died.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, this is a larger... This isn't just a funny ball thing anymore.
Yeah. The character of Sydney Sweeney, who plays his daughter, and her college bud being on the trip, they're just total bitches. Just total assholes.
Yeah. Complete jerks.
A lot of the characters are on this show just idiots or jerks, in a way. Are you looking for her to get hers, Natalie? Do you want her to be taken down a peg?
Not yet. Just because that character of girls that age, it's everywhere.
Yes.
It's in on every show. It's all over the internet. That's just the way that girls are portrayed right now. So I don't know that that's going to be like consequential, you know? It could just be, hey, this girl's kind of bitchy.
Well, it's everywhere in fiction because it's also a whole lot of places in reality.
Right.
And I want those privileged... rich white girls to be taken down a peg in real life. So to see it in, in my fiction would work well for me. So my second question is, do you think this is going to be one we'll talk about in the coming weeks? Or so do you recommend it based off one episode?
It was a strong recommend from me. I think we...
Oh, yeah.
We finished the first episode and kind of looked at each other like, oh, that was pretty good.
Yeah, I gotcha. Going into it, I wondered if I would like it. I even questioned if I would watch it. And I went all in on, based on the cast, is why I ended up watching the first episode. So, and it delivered, I think. I think it'll be pretty good. We'll see, though. We'll probably bring it up again.
It felt kind of the same speed as the, what's the Hugh Laurie in space movie or show that HBO did last year?
Avenue 5?
Yeah. It felt akin to that. You know, there are the mayors of Easttown and the true detectives of the HBO world. And then there's kind of the B-team. You know, and this felt like a very strong entry into that second tier. Like, I don't think it's going to blow any minds, but I think it's, you know, the acting was a bit stronger than most of those usually get. And I'm impressed. I mean, even the way that it was shot during the pandemic, you know, having the idea to go to, we joked with each other that, well, I'm sure this was a hard sell for the crew and actors. You get to go live in Hawaii for probably a month and a half, 2 months, and film a show when you're otherwise not going to be getting any work during a pandemic. I think it'll be good. It's going to be good, as Tobias would say.
There was a feature in Vulture, in New York Magazine as well, where a writer talked to Jennifer Coolidge about her role in this and how it's kind of going to feature her a lot. She's going to be part of some main storylines. And this is kind of why I backed off from the show initially. Supposedly, the story is Mike White came to HBO for a show, and they said, well, give us something that's COVID restriction friendly. And he basically said, okay, well, send me to Hawaii and we'll do a resort show. That kind of, you know, when it doesn't happen organically, when a show or a piece of art doesn't happen because the artist felt like he or she had something to say. But maybe he had this cooking anyway, and he's got... The show is certainly one of those shows that could have a lot to say. There's a lot that could be done with this show, and maybe they'll do it.
Working within limitations also, to me, provide for pretty great art. You know, restricting your options of what you can do. There was a limited space that they could move this plot around in, and that, and I think that works well in art, music... film, so I'm intrigued by the rest of it.
It reminds me a lot of the story where David Milch, who wrote Deadwood, he was the showrunner for Deadwood, goes to HBO and tells them, I've got this show in mind about the lawlessness of Rome and what that's like. And they say, well, we already have a show about Rome in production. And he says, did I say Rome?
Right.
Actually, I meant Deadwood. So anyway, yeah, you're right. Sure could. All right. Well, we're going to talk about this one. I'm glad we set aside some time to talk about the Hulu documentary series with Paul McCartney and Rick Rubin called McCartney 321. As if we aren't already getting a glut of McCartney coming in Thanksgiving, along with plenty of Beatles stuff already out there. Here comes Rick Rubin, Paul McCartney to talk about music on Hulu. And we three are the perfect audience for it. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are the perfect audience for this. I am the type who has gone on YouTube and found those videos where they drop whatever instrument out of the mix so you can really dive into how the song is put together.
Oh yeah.
I'm a sucker for that at times, but I won't watch it at length because up until a few years ago you didn't have the Roku to pull up YouTube on your TV. That's basically what this show is. It's really fascinated they made a 6-episode show about it. I've watched all 6, and I bet you guys consumed these quickly too.
We made it halfway through and then got a little busy yesterday. Friday evening, we kind of had to pump the brakes to make it last a bit longer. We made it, you know, the 3 episodes, and I thought, well, we need to save something and not just inhale all of this right now, which is, I definitely could have done. I think this will end up, you know, it reminds me a bit of, remember that show Classic Albums? that they made for a few years. It's
yes, that's exactly.
It's kind of the same format as that, only it's better produced to me. I mean, I think those were great works, the classic albums. But maybe the difference here is I read an interview with the director who said that, you know, everything was designed so that this conversation between Rubin and McCartney could happen pretty organically. Like, they didn't have to change lighting ever. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if McCartney was at the recording console and wanted to explain how a part worked on the piano, he could just walk over there and do it. And there was no interference from the film crew. They shot with long lenses so that they were kind of, you know, not just in their face the whole time. And having
mm-hmm.
Rick Rubin be the guy who tees everything up, I think he, you know, his...
Yeah.
I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of his work with the Broken Record podcast. I think him as an interviewer mm-hmm. of musicians, both ones that he's worked with and ones that he hasn't, he's the best in the game right now to me. And it maybe speaks to why he's such a sought-after producer, that he can kind of crawl around and really zero in on what makes an artist tick. But man, it works in this show.
Recent news about Rick Rubin, if I'm not mistaken, is that he's going to branch out and do even more television-related stuff. I don't know if it'll be quite like this, but we'll see.
That would be great. And I think there's some level of consciousness right now that, you know, you talked about kind of the glut of music documentaries that have happened and will be happening for the next few months. Like, we just talked about Summer of Soul a few weeks ago. We've obviously got the Beatles doc to look forward to in fall. There may be a certain awareness, not to sour our conversation with a bit of morbidity, but, you know, these guys are not going to be around to tell firsthand stories for too much longer. You know, it's hard to envision this. If Paul is still with us in 10 to 15 years, it would not have the same vibe and vitality that it does right now. And so I think capturing say Mavis Staples' words for the Summer of Soul, these people who are foundational or bridges between eras of culture, is just so valuable. And to hear the I was there stories, or I did this, I created this, is just, it's so good. I mean, this got me so amped up. I mean, I felt like I could have just stood on my chair and jumped up and down watching this.
Yeah. Yeah, it had those moments for me, for sure. Although, to counter what you're saying, Sir Paul looks fantastic for a 79-year-old man.
He does. I didn't want to jinx anything by saying that out loud. Yeah, he looks good, and he's moving around, and...
And it seems, you know, healthy.
Memory's sharp and clear, yeah.
Everything. And he would play air drums and play air guitar to the music, and he just looked energetic. And I was just proud of him. He's 79, Dylan's 80. I mean, you're right about that, these things. How is it that old footage of the Beatles is so transportive that it makes me nostalgic for a time period that I've never been in? It just instantly takes me back to a time period that it can take me back to.
For such a shared cultural consciousness, like a touchstone of who we are now, that music, the 60s, all that sort of thing. And I was talking with friends last night about, everybody can relate, I think, to the feeling that they must have had where those were their adolescent buddies and they just happened to become the most famous people on earth and could do no wrong, and then it fell apart. Much like, you know, my buddy Andy said, when you're hanging out with people when you're 20, you're like, I'm going to be friends with these people forever. You know, you couldn't envision that your crew wasn't going to stick together. And of course, that's not how life works. But for them, they cemented something that we all feel in an incredible body of work. And I think maybe that has some sort of subconscious, while we keep coming back to the story, just beyond how incredible the music is. Maybe that's reaching. Maybe most people don't think that deeply about it. I don't know, but it always affects me.
Natalie, what did you think about while you were watching this? Just love?
Because it depends. But typically these like the classic albums things, not super into it. Some of them I am. There are some that I really enjoyed watching and others that I just didn't care. And it didn't matter what they were talking about. just didn't hold my attention. But this, kind of like what Adam was saying, the way that they, you know, set up these conversations and the storytelling was, that's what drew me in, and that's what made it exciting. I mean, of course, listening to these songs, you know, these are songs that we've all known forever because they're everywhere and they're amazing. But to hear, again, like Adam said, just that kind of first person experience and, you know, these little backstories about, you know, him growing up with George on the bus and riding the bus and hitchhiking across town or whatever, you know, the way that those conversations came up so naturally, the way that the entire thing was set up and the way that Rick Rubin was able to kind of map it or take it in whatever direction, it was just so natural. It never felt scripted or like, here are the bullet points we got to hit. So for me, that was more, not more compelling, but just held my attention better than like the technical, let's dig into the songs part, which I think is a good thing because that just opens up the show to, you know, a broader audience. I also think that anytime Paul McCartney is sitting on a couch, he looks like a grandmother, and I think it's really cute. So that's my takeaway.
I learned to take happenstance and turn it into art. The idea of taking those malapropisms or Ringoisms is just beautiful. Is that, have you watched that episode yet?
I don't know if we've made it to that, but like we had some, like where he describes getting the title to Sergeant Pepper.
That's one, yes.
That he thought the member of the road crew said Sergeant Pepper. He really just wanted the salt and pepper for his his on-plane meal.
Yes, that's a good example. Meal.
But just elevating the, there's everything from that, elevating what would be the mundane and filtering it through.
We live in the mundane, and if you want to comment on life, then, you know, you turn the mundane into art or say something about it. Sir Paul's solo work is probably my least favorite post-Beatles work, I think. But he may be the best interview, though, which is proven in this show. He understands the craft of song in and out of the studio. And speaking of how he's the ideal guy to do this, so is Rick Rubin. I've never been more intrigued with a producer, maybe. In some circles, I know that he catches some flack because he isn't a musician. But come on, this series is just a masterclass in having knowledge.
Yeah, I think anybody that doesn't give him full credit because he's not a musician, I think that's really silly. Because ultimately, to me, things that I like, I'm not responding to them on an intellectual level, you know? It's not purely
line.
How does it make me feel, but a huge part of it's like, what is this connecting, you know, connecting with other human beings?
Where are you on Rick Rubin even before the Broken Record podcast? Did you have respect for him? Did you like him? Either of y'all know where the dog octave is in Sgt. Pepper's? Yeah, maybe you didn't. Maybe that's in episode 4 or something. There's a note, and I don't know how long the note's held in Sgt. Pepper's where only dogs can hear it. He admits he doesn't know where it is. And this might come a little later, but it's no spoiler. But Rick Rubin says it perfectly, that the songs are so ubiquitous that you don't think about the parts that make the whole. And sometimes certain songs are so ubiquitous that you even forget that they're great. That happens to me, especially with Beatles songs. They're so renowned and everyone knows them, that hearing them deconstructed like this reminds me of, God, I want to go back and listen to this song because I want to hear, I want to see if I could hear the bass line on, you know, in the chorus or whatever, right? And Natalie, did you get that feeling? I know you said that you're not really interested as much.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, there were a few things that came up, like even if it's just like a strumming pattern or something, that, like, I don't know that I would go back purposefully and go listen for it, but when they would go play the example of it or like the piece of that song, like to be able to just like kind of like, oh yeah, that is interesting, or that's really cool. And then I'm sure in the future when I do hear those songs again, you know, that's going to come up. So, I mean, I'm not going to seek it out necessarily, but I still really enjoyed hearing it in the moment that they were talking about it.
I'll say this as we start to wrap. His excitement and fandom of Beatles music reminds me a whole lot of having the pleasure of listening to Dexateen's albums with Sweet Dog. Like, because Sweet Dog will do that. He'll do that while he's playing you the song. He'll say, listen to this part. Elliot was doing this, or John was playing this, or Matt. Listen to Matt's bass right here. It's really fun. So being a fan of your own music is, I think that's frowned upon, but I also think it can be really endearing. And with that endearment, we'll bring it to a close. That's our show for you this week, and we honestly hope you enjoyed it. We enjoyed doing this. It's a fun part of our week. Tell a friend about us, and share us, and retweet us, and say hello. We hope to hear from you all. That's it. Goodbye.